So we're going to an interview now with Rehana Mohideen. Rehana is a long-term socialist, feminist, activist. She's the head of the International Committee of the Party of the Laboring Masses, or the PLM, which is a revolutionary socialist party in the Philippines. She's active in the Philippines women's movement and in international socialist and feminist networks. And she's also a longtime friend of mine. Good morning, Rehana.
Good morning, Mary.
Well, okay.
Thank you for that introduction.
My pleasure. Okay, first question. What can we celebrate for women, or what is there, sorry, to celebrate for women in the Philippines and other parts of the Southeast? What in the West can we learn from the women's movements and some of the issues important to women in the Southeast region?
Well, there's nothing to celebrate, really, apart from the fact that women have survived incredible onslaughts over the last few decades in all forms. And it's a question of continuing to struggle and, in fact, intensifying the struggle for women's rights, for gender equality, for women's liberation overall. In the Philippines, this coming March 8th, we've got a big demonstrations planned, and some of the key issues that we'll be concentrating on is the abolition of political dynasties. The political system in the Philippines is controlled by dynasties, and in the Philippine Congress, about 90% of the Congress are representatives of dynasties. This also applies to some of the other Southeast Asian countries, such as Indonesia, where political dynasties have an enormous influence over politics there. The legalization of divorce in the Philippines, which is a very conservative Catholic country, divorce is not illegal. Decriminalization of abortion, a major issue for women in the Philippines. Comprehensive sexual education. And we've also got a SOGI bill tabled in Congress, that sexual orientation and gender identity expression equality bill against discrimination of LGBTQ+ communities and for marriage equality. Then there's questions of the minimum wage, to ban contractualization and regularize employment, affordable and decent housing, and the climate question. This is a really important question for women, to phase out coal-fired power plants, and begin a democratic, community-controlled just transition. This is an important question for women in Southeast Asia. The imposition of a wealth tax. We're demanding a wealth tax to be established for various programs to be funded, and against militarization in the region. And this is a really critical question for women in Southeast Asia, and this includes the removal of U.S. bases and for a truly independent and international foreign policy. Removal of U.S. bases and to end all military agreements with imperialist countries, including Australia. And this is also the platform that PLM candidates are standing on, two Senate candidates, Leodidi Guzman and Luke Espiritu, and we've got elections in May.
Well, that's a huge agenda in front of you and the PLM and feminists in general in the Southeast. So you mentioned militarism and war, and of course it disproportionately impacts women. Can you perhaps go into a bit more detail about how or what those impacts are?
This is the question of campaigning to end and to repeal all military agreements with some of the, imperialist countries in the region that we have. With the Philippines, it's a visiting forces agreement with the United States. With Australia, there are two agreements. The visiting forces the SOVFAR, the Status of Visiting Forces Agreement, and an Enhanced Defense Cooperation Program, or EDCAP. The result of this militarism is it's a historic there's a historic aspect to it, because there have been U.S. bases in the region for a very long time. So it's not just a part of this militarism, increase in militarism against China, for example, in South Korea and Okinawa in the Philippines. These are two very large, permanently established U.S. bases. And these are the, some of the largest U.S. bases outside the ones in the United States itself. I mean, there's been, it's been recorded over time, the impact on violence against women. There's a direct impact of having troops, interveless troops, whether it's from the United States or Australia, but especially the U.S., because they've had a big presence, a military presence in the region for a long time. I mean, it's been recorded, and there are so many cases that come to mind. In the Philippines, the most recent case was the killing, the really brutal, brutal killing of a young Filipina transgender woman called Jennifer Laude. The Marine who was responsible, Scott Pemberton, he was actually pardoned for this. And he was pardoned in the U.S. because troops under these agreements have impunity. They are not subject to Philippine law. So it's very hard to take them to the courts. So at best, what you can do is you can go to the Philippine courts and demand that they be kept in the Philippines, that they be jailed in the Philippines, or that they just be held in the Philippines. But in the case of Pemberton, he was smuggled out of the country through the U.S. embassy and, of course, through the U.S. presence, and taken to the U.S. And we kept insisting, and our lawyers went over there as well, insisting that he be tried and he was pardoned. So, you know, there are so many cases. In South Korea also, there was a case of a young woman really brutally raped, Yoon Kum-i. And in Okinawa, there are, again, you know, a case of a drunken U.S. soldier going into a house and molesting a young girl who was sleeping in her home, in her bed, and so on. And these are documented as well. So there's a direct correlation. And in our practical experience of an increase in violence against women and the presence of U.S. and other imperialist troops who have impunity.
Yes, thanks, Rohana. Just talking about the U.S., of course, now we've got President Trump, and he plans to cut more than 90% of U.S. aid, foreign aid contracts. What can you say about the role of foreign aid from the global north countries, what role it plays in reinforcing capitalist relations in the global south, and what will be some of the impacts of globalization on women following Trump cutting the foreign aid?
It's a double-edged sword, foreign aid. Some of the poorer economies in the global south are very dependent it's almost impossible for some of these countries to be able to industrialize or develop, if you like, in any way as individual countries, because everything is stacked against them. It's almost impossible to do unless there is a regional setup, a regional cooperation, and a regional plan for industrialization, for sustainable industrialization, and so on. They are so very dependent. But I should also say that there's a history to this, and it's a history of colonialism and imperialism, which has meant there is this fundamental divide between nations in the world that we call, sometimes it's referred to as the Global South, and of course the Western powers as part of the Global North, and that includes Australia and Japan. So, you know, there's a history to this of colonialism, where our societies were destroyed, industries that existed were destroyed, and this dependence was forced on countries of the Global South. And it's in this context the question of compensation and reparation to colonialism has come up. And I know this is an issue in Australia, in the amongst the First Nations communities. And when Charles, the head of the monarchy in the UK, was King Charles, was touring, there was a claim for reparation that was put forward, and this came up in Australia and in the Pacific. There's a study that has been done by the University of West Indies that says that the UK should pay $36.6 trillion for its involvement in slavery in 14 countries. So, you know, there's this question of compensation and reparation and the history that needs to be understood. But coming back to the question of aid, Australia's aid budget is really quite pathetic, or overseas development assistance. It's around $5 billion, which is less than 0.2% of the gross national income in Australia. And it's also below the OECD average of around 0.3%. So these are very small amounts of money that are being given as so-called aid, and they have all sorts of political strings attached in terms of which compromise and undermine the national sovereignty of countries in the Global South. Now, the Trump administration's dismantling of USAID, they basically they've got it now under their Department of Defense, I think. Department of Foreign Affairs. Anyway, it's under that department, which is a bit similar to what happened in Australia, too, where U.S. AusAid was restructured and came under DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So it's a similar kind of thing, but essentially under Trump administration, it's dismantling of USAID and dismantling of their entire overseas aid program. And even though we have been very critical of the political compromises that countries have to make under USAID funding in particular, because these are all bottom line, they further the interests of these big powers. Bottom line, they further the interests of these big powers. Australia will not give aid if it undermines its interests. It will only give aid, and those aid packages are linked to supporting Australian interests in the region. That is the absolute bottom line of these aid packages, and this has been very obvious in the case of USAID. However, some of these packages do fund important programs, especially in some of the poorer countries. Health is going to get a really hard kick under the end or the freeze of USAID funding. Maternity health care programs will be affected. AIDS program will be affected, And the AIDS Global Fund has been, and the U.S. contribution to AIDS Global Funding has been frozen. And this is going to affect not so much is going to affect especially the prevention of AIDS. So while it's a double-edged sword and they ultimately serve U.S. interests or Australian interests, they do have an impact, especially in some of the poorer countries.
Yes, thank you. Moving on to a totally different question, what do you think women's liberation has to look like for all women, whether in the Global North or the Global South?
So in terms of the global situation for in feminism. I think there are some things that we need to understand, and that is we need to understand the divisions in feminism globally. I think the class question is emerging or has already emerged as a central question in feminism. And it's hard to see feminism as a all-encompassing umbrella because of these questions that have to be acknowledged and addressed. And I think our feminism has to pivot, if you like. I don't like the use of that term, but our feminism has to adjust to prioritizing these questions within it, such as class, such as imperialism and the divisions between the global north and global south. You can't be a genuine feminist today without acknowledging the genocide in Gaza and yes. the colonization of Palestine by Israel and the role of the United States. So you have to be, a feminist today has to be anti-imperialist. A feminist today has to recognize questions of class and the divisions around class. And I think this is important because of we have seen a co-optation of the gender agenda. We have seen a co-optation of feminism. We know this as socialists and feminists. We have understood this since the 70s. We have seen this and how it accelerated in the 80s and so on. But the gender agenda has been co-opted. It has been bourgeoisified. It's very hard for us today as feminists to find points of unity with what we used to call and what is bourgeois feminism today. So I think there are these fundamental divides within feminism. I think we have to understand where these divides are and we have to adjust accordingly. Some would argue that Western feminism overall has been co-opted. This is a view amongst feminists in the global south, that Western feminism has been co-opted. When we have Western feminists supporting the genocide in Gaza, supporting imperialist backing for Israel and military funding for Israel, it's very hard not to. It's on that basis that these criticisms of Western feminism and this divide in feminism between the global south and the global north emerge. So it's important for us to, as socialist feminists, to understand this. And I think it's in this context also it's important for us as socialist feminists. So, and here I'm not necessarily, I don't want to go into the debate between Marxist feminism and socialist feminism, because I think today we can call Marxist feminists socialist feminists because the old socialist feminists have by and large been co-opted. But so as socialist feminists, I think we need to understand this and put forward a socialist alternative or a transitional socialist alternative as a part of the feminist agenda.
Yes, thank you, Rohana. I think we have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for getting up this early and being our guest this morning. And perhaps we'll catch up with you on one of your other visits to Australia. So thank you.
Thank you too for Green Left and the Socialist Alliance.